nothing new. Certainly, theorists have been following the subject closely will know everything I'm going to talk about. But I think the overall perspective is rather different in terms of what one normally reads about in textbooks or review articles, and I think may be different than that that many different view of inflation that I think many observers would see of the subject. But I thought it was important to present this perspective in a conference on the frontiers of modern cosmology, because I think it points to some of the serious challenges one has yet to conquer in inflation. It provides some motivation for thinking about alternatives, and it points the way to important observations that can play an important role in guiding us. So, inflation, the concept of inflation was introduced about 27 years ago, and in about 4 years after that, within 4 years, all the key ideas were added to, all the key ideas were, well, too extreme. Someone else was controlling the lights. We'll take care. I'm not controlling the lights. All the key ideas were added that comprise essentially the foundations of the inflationary theory as most people think about it today. In particular, it was clear by that point that it was a theory with great explanatory power, great predictive power. Explanatory power, simply the idea that the universe underwent a brief period of exponentially rapid expansion, was sufficient to explain in one shot the horizon, flatness, monopole, and entropy problems. I mentioned the entropy problem. Let me say a little more about it for now because I'm going to come back to it later. If you look back at Alan Guth's original presentation or argument for inflation, he presented it in terms of the entropy problem. The idea that if you look at the entropy of the universe today, instead of being something of order unity, it's an exponentially big number, around 10 to the 90th. And he viewed that as a problem, and one of the ways of solving that problem was to have a very non-adiabatic process like inflation, a period of rapid expansion followed by reheating. And then he essentially linked the horizon, flatness, and monopole problems to this solution to the entropy problem, showing that by producing this much entropy, you also at the same stroke solve the horizon, flatness, and monopole problems. Now, it's also a theory, as I said, with great predictive power. It predicts that the total omega is equal to unity. And then if you include the effects of quantum physics, it predicts a nearly scale invariant spectrum of density fluctuations and gravitational waves. And as I said, this is the picture that most of us have of inflation. And by the year 2000, this view of inflation was already seen to be in magnificent agreement with data. And Lyman and Mark have showed further evidence of that, at least so far as the measurements of flatness and density fluctuations are concerned. And of course, we're awaiting measurements of gravitational waves. Now, also in this early period, another idea was added, which quickly became absorbed as a sort of foundational idea in the inflationary paradigm, and that's the idea of eternal inflation, which, although it wasn't there at the outset, once it was realized as a possibility, many people now think it is an absolutely essential element. And in particular, I quote a review article by Alan Guth in which he argues that once one accepts the idea that eternal inflation is a logical possibility, then there's no contest in comparing an eternally inflating version of inflation with any theory that is not eternal. So one-shot inflation is disfavored compared to, he'd say completely disfavored compared to an eternal inflation model. So of course, what he's talking about is a model where, is a situation in which the universe begins, say, in a false vacuum, and you might think, normally, that it would, after a certain period of time, inflation would come to an end, and you would end up with a normal universe containing ordinary matter and radiation. In fact, the story is different than that. What really happens is that although a large fraction of the universe at the first instant turns into normal universe, there are occasionally, due to rare quantum fluctuations, regions left behind in the false vacuum. Regions which you might normally ignore, except for the fact that they're continuing to inflate. And because they continue to inflate, after a few instants, they actually dominate the volume of the universe. So instead of most of the universe having ended inflation, instead what you have is the reverse situation. A small pocket of the universe ends inflation, leaving behind mostly inflating vacuum, which then produces yet further pockets and yet further pockets and further pockets. Now, this idea of eternal inflation points to what I think is an important change in where the outlook or the viewpoint of inflation. The classical viewpoint, what I might call the classical perspective on inflation, the idea that we had leading up to this point, was that inflation was essentially involved a classical physics phenomenon, classical GR phenomenon, in which you have a smoothing process, which is this classical effect, and in which quantum physics only plays a minor perturbative role, a nice role in producing density fluctuations, but a minor perturbative role. I think what internal inflation teaches us is that, in fact, the situation is quite different than that. Inflation is primarily a quantum physics-dominated role, in which the role that inflation itself is doing is amplifying quantum effects. So, classically, where you might have expected things to simply end inflation and the universe to be mostly normal, in fact, what we're seeing is that due to rare quantum fluctuations and the fact that inflation amplifies rare quantum fluctuations, the situation, the large-scale structure of the universe is quite the reverse. It's mostly inflating, and only pockets of the universe end up in the normal phase.
Now, on the horizontal axis there.
This picture actually makes things much, does not represent anything mathematically, except for the fact that you have this breakup into pockets. So I don't want you to think of it
which are spatially disjoint.
Which are spatially disjoint, which are separated by false vacuum phase. So in fact, this picture also suggests a picture which is much neater than the reality. Here's the reality. Here's closer to what the reality looks like. This is from a simulation by Linde and Nazlumian. And in this case, it's representing the fact that if you began with a universe which was a perfectly smooth manifold, which is what they began with, and then you let the system go, over time, what happens, of course, is you produce these pocket universes. And these pocket universes change the local density and change the local geometry. And they're represented, in these pockets, is represented by one of these spikes over here that's representing a local distortion in the geometry. And what you're really seeing is that this effect that what began with a perfectly ordered state is becoming more and more disordered. So in fact, that's an important lesson to think about, a profound lesson actually to think about. Whereas intuitively, we think about inflation as a smoothing and ordering effect. It is, in a certain sense, because it's inflating quantum physics, it is, in a certain sense, a disordering effect. Here it began with something perfectly smooth, and it became more and more disordered on a certain scale. Okay, so that relates to all the issues I'm going to talk about our view of inflation today. That if you think about it as amplifying quantum physics, and quantum physics is being inherently random, then the view of inflation is different than the conventional outlook. And this leads to a number of problems. That's really what I want to focus on, a number of problems that emerge in the theory as it stands today. So one problem with the inflationary theory at the moment is what's called the singularity problem. The idea that inflationary space-times, when you look back in time, are geodesically incomplete. This is first pointed out by Boyd and Palenkin, and more recently in a paper by Boyd, Guth, and Palenkin. I should say that when, in the early 80s, when inflation was being invented, there were a few of us that harbored the hope that
once you had inflation, you might be able to avoid the cosmological singularity altogether. You might be able to attach something onto the beginning of it that would lead to a new inflation and then onto a universe that looks like we see today. Or, if you couldn't get rid of the singularity altogether, at least you could erase the memory of it. And what this theorem by Boyd, Guth, and Palenkin shows is that things are more subtle than that. And it begins, it's related to the fact that we have this quantum physics involved and not simply purely classical expansion. So if I had a pure de Sitter space, which is sort of the cartoon image of what inflation is, then of course a pure de Sitter space can be completely non-singular. It goes to an infinite amount of contraction and an infinite amount of expansion. But that's not what we want. We want a system which looks nearly de Sitter, but has enough deviation from it that we end up with pockets that look like what we observe. So it cannot be perfectly de Sitter. And the point is, the smallest deviation from de Sitter changes in a fundamental way the singularity structure. So for example, if you imagine a universe which is slightly unstable, it can occasionally, maybe rarely, maybe exponentially rarely, tunnel to produce pockets like our own, And that eliminates the possibility of having a universe which begins with a contracting de Sitter phase and then expanding, because already, even with the smallest finite non-zero nucleation rate of pockets of normal universe, during this contraction phase, you'd end up percolating the universe with these bubbles of normal phase, and you'd never emerge to any inflation. So the fact that you have the slightest instability changes the story in a fundamental way, and that you can only, that you can get an in that you cannot attach on to an expanding de Sitter phase, the other part of de Sitter space, which is the contracting one. Instead, you need some other kind of initial condition to save to attach on to this, in order to get to where you want to get to, which is an expanding universe with bubbles being produced. We'll come to that. We'll come to that. We'll work our way towards that. And in fact, with the theorem of Guth-Bord and Blenkin, really it's that telling you is that as I extrapolate from any inflationary space-time back in time, I'm going to go smash-bang into a singularity or whatever replaces a singularity. I might have thought that I could be safe from that, but I can't. Now, you might say, well, maybe I'm at least inoculated from the singularity. And, well, we'll get into this in more detail in a moment, but one reason that you might have to worry about that is, suppose I'm in one of these bubbles over here, and the beginning of my bubble is at this point, this vertex over here, I might ask, how far am I, given lots and lots of inflation, how far am I from this initial value surface? And the answer is coming on that telephone call. No. And the answer, of course, is, you're not very far from the initial value surface in a certain sense. If you imagine a massless particle launched at that bubble from the initial value surface, any information that travels at the speed of light, of course, the proper time or proper distance is zero to that bubble. So in a sense, when you're inside that bubble, even though you might think in this picture that there's a lot of inflation, in a certain sense, information can get to you from the initial value surface essentially instantly. Now, you might say, OK, well, maybe I don't expect any such dangerous emanations to come from the initial value surface, and I can have enough inflation here to erase any such information. We'll see in a moment whether, in a bit, whether or not that idea is plausible. But this is just a warning sign that you're not really inoculated from it. The moment you have this initial value surface, well, even drawing this picture where the inflation is uniform is making a strong assumption about that initial value surface. Well, what you need is a theory of initial conditions to tell us how likely this later story is. Okay, a second problem which emerges because of this inherent quantum nature, which is what I'm trying to emphasize, this quantum nature of inflation, is what I call the predictability problem. So what Alan was latching onto as being attractive is the idea that once inflation starts, it runs away forever, making more and more inflating space and producing more and more pockets like our own. But corollary of that is it also produces an infinite number of pockets that are not like our own, due to, again, the effect of inflation to inflate or amplify quantum physics effects. So as an inflaton field is rolling downhill, it can undergo random quantum fluctuations along the way, which are sometimes large, okay? Large enough that it will change the spectrum of density fluctuations in some significant way, or even large enough to change the curvature you end up with when you end up at the bottom of the hill. So not only does internal inflation produce an infinite number of bubbles which are like us, it produces an infinite number of bubbles which are open, an infinite number of bubbles which have density fluctuations which are different than ours. Yes, Annie.
That's good enough.
Okay.
and bear in mind, the simulation started with it being perfectly smooth. Okay, so this is what inflation does.
We'll get to the colors.
We're going to get into the colors in a sec.
Right. Is there more structure in the middle than at the edges?
I don't know enough about the history of this particular snapshot, but it should be uniform. There should be nothing special about any particular.
What do the axes mean?
You mean the up and down?
Up and down, right.
The curvature changes. The curvature, you're looking at a snapshot of a piece of space, fine? Okay. Okay, and then the geometry changes when part of it goes normal and the rest of it remains inflating. That's going to distort the local geometry, and that's represented here by a spike. So the bubble, the insides of these open patches, these pocket universes, are at the very tips of those spikes, separated by a domain wall, separated by a bubble wall from the exterior. So that's what.
So X and Y is space and Z is curvature or something.
It's something like that, right? So,
well, this is done, everything in Kamuvian coordinates. So yes. It's not really representative. So on the top of the stripes, you have the biggest volume. Yeah?
We're going to work our way up the piece. We'll get there. I promise. Okay, so the unpredictability problem means that essentially you don't have a normalized probability distribution. But if you produce an infinite amount of everything, you can't come back and argue for me why it's more probable. There's no meaningful mathematical way for explaining why it's more probable if you end up in a flat bubble rather than an open bubble, or a bubble with a nearly scale invariant spectrum fluctuations rather than one that's not. I mean, it has not prevented people from trying to do so. So there is sort of two attempts to try to. I think you're leaning back against the.
I'm not doing anything.
No, you are doing
it.
But there's a switch at your back. So if you trust this prediction, you can trust all the rest of that prediction. So there are attempts to try to find what I call a global solution to this problem. That's to try to, even though what I just said sounds rather difficult, it sounds like you have unnormalized distributions, it sounds like it's impossible. There are attempts to find schemes, prescriptions, for trying to calculate the relative, given some internal inflationary model, what the relative probabilities are of, let's say, flat to curve, et cetera. But they're up against two problems. One is that, the one I already mentioned, the distributions are not normalized, so there is no at least sound mathematical scheme for doing this. And number two, you might imagine an alternative approach. We'd say, well, I'll just take a time slice out of this picture and ask how many bubbles within a given time slice. I won't look at all bubbles, but just within that time slice, how many are open or how many curve, how many have the right density fluctuation distribution, et cetera. And the problem with that scheme is, of course, general relativity doesn't give a single prescription for your time slice. I can choose my time slices in different ways. And it turns out it's not too hard to discover that by choosing my time slices in different ways, I can get any answer that I want. So I could find that flat is more probable or curved is more probable. In fact, what I'm discovering, I believe, at least in my view, what you're discovering is that it's actually, in this global sense, unpredictable. It's fundamentally unpredictable. It's part of the structure of the eternally inflating theory due to the effect of quantum physics producing this kind of disorder. So there are schemes, as I said, for trying to do this. You'll see there's a literature on it. But you'll find that at some point in these schemes, they go to a reasonableness argument. They test these schemes by saying, OK, I'll test it against some calculations which I think I know the answer to. And if I get the answer I want, then I'll say that's thumbs up for that scheme. If I don't get the answer I don't want, I'll say thumbs down for that scheme. In my view, this is just fiddling with what is inherently an ill-defined problem. Now, I'm more sympathetic with the local description approach. And that approach says, OK, I can't really deal with this unnormalized distribution, but I can ask a different question. Given where I am today in some bubble, I can ask, what is the probability of getting to those conditions given what happened in my past? So I don't worry about things which are space-like separated from me. I just worry about what's in my past light cone. And I ask, given what's in the past, what's the probability of getting, let's say, a flat universe or conditions like I see today? This is most recently represented by from the work of Raphael Busso, in which he talks not about the past light cone. He likes to talk about a causal diamond. But I just want to point out that's really the same thing. He restricts himself to thinking about this diamond because he says information that travels from these triangles to the observer must pass through the diamond, so it's sufficient to talk about the diamond. But the diamond obscures an important feature, which is the tip of this diamond, and more generally, this light cone over here, hits the initial value surface. Which means if I want to explain what's going to happen in the future, what are the conditions here, I run right into the fact that, I run right smack dab into the fact that my space-time is geodesically incomplete. And in order to make this prediction, I must know something about that initial value surface, the same problem we had before. And here we're running into it in spades because it's preventing us from solving the unpredictability problem. Now, there is one example, a notable example, of an attempt to try to complete the space-time in a way that would be, you then could make firm mathematical predictions as to what's going to happen. This is known as the no-boundary proposal of Hawking's.
Well, the bad news there is that when you follow that proposal forward, you find that given the no-boundary proposal, where you're likely to end up is not a universe which ends up in a phase with an inflaton that's high on a potential, but rather an inflaton which is as low as possible on the potential with minimum energy density. So you're likely to end up with an empty, with a nearly empty, non-inflated universe rather than an inflating universe. And you can make an inflated universe by occasionally making upward fluctuations and getting to an inflated universe, but you're much exponentially more likely to produce a universe that doesn't get quite enough inflation and ends up open rather than flat. So the one scheme we have that might, you know, have in hand so far for getting around this problem, unfortunately, leads to not a low lambda universe. It is a low lambda universe, but it's more generally a low energy density universe, which is open rather than flat. Then most recently, there's an effect which I probably find the most disturbing, and it's an effect which is known as persistence of memory. So now we're going to get to your question, Scott. And this is an issue that was an effect that was pointed out by Gariga, Guth, and Belenkin. As far as I know, they were the first to point it out, and more recently been explored by Aguirre, Johnson, and Schomer. And I'm going to describe this effect, but in a way which is a little bit different, has a different emphasis than either of them did, because it relates to the theme that I'm trying to present. I think what this persistence of memory cuts to is a very fundamental question, which is, does inflation really make the universe homogeneous and isotropic? I've sort of argued already, in sort of philosophical grounds, that because it amplifies quantum effects, in a sense, it's a disordering phenomenon rather than an ordering phenomenon. But here we're going to see that come back as a kind of nightmare problem for us. So to set up this discussion, let's first of all try to make a universe which is as favorable as possible for making a homogeneous universe. So as favorable as possible, I'm going to choose a toy model, which is what they've chosen here, in which you begin with the universe which has, it's a kind of artificial looking model, but you have a potential in which the universe is trapped in a false vacuum phase by an energy barrier. And every now and then, it nucleates a bubble. That's our quantum instability effect, which then, well, we don't want the bubble to be empty, so we don't want to tunnel right to here, so we put a little plateau in here. It tunnels to there, it rolls down here, inflates a little bit more on the inside, and reheats, so you end up with a reasonable physics inside the bubble. Now, this tunneling process, because it occurs exponentially rarely and because the universe is expanding exponentially quickly, is never going to percolate. These bubbles are never going to percolate the universe. And so this produces a kind of a nice toy example of an eternal inflation effect. In general, you would have eternal inflation due to fluctuations along this ridge as well. But for the purposes of this toy discussion, I'm going to assume there is no such effect. I'll assume that the only eternal effect is due to the nucleation of these bubbles. We'll come back and think about the other effect in a moment. Okay. Furthermore, to keep matters as nice as possible, we'll assume that there's some initial value surface which I'll insist is perfectly homogeneous. Perfectly homogeneous, in particular, it has no bubbles along it. Notice this is giving away the thing that we're trying to get from inflation, which is homogeneity, but we'll see that it makes no difference. That will be the interesting thing. So we'll assume there's some initial surface in which things are perfectly homogeneous. Okay, then what happens is we nucleate a bubble. And here's one of these bubbles nucleating, and its bubble wall is traveling out at the speed of light. Now notice already there's something peculiar that happened here. We began with something perfectly homogeneous, and now it's not homogeneous. That's the same effect we were talking about before, but I'm just trying to emphasize it. But you might say, I didn't worry about that because inside the bubble, or on one of these tips of one of these spikes, things look very homogeneous. It looks like a perfectly open Friedman-Robertson-Walker universe, where if I've had a certain degree of inflation, which is indicated in red, looks, although it's open, is very, very close to flat, to at least, you know, 4 decimal points or more. Inside my bubble, I have these hypersurfaces of constant time. They look like hyperboloids. There's some guy in the center of this hyperboloid. It might be some guy out here. At first, in this picture, they might seem to be inequivalent. But they actually are equivalent in the sense that, well, first of all, anything this observer sees, they see locally, you know, they see the same same geometry and energy density distribution. And more than that, I can produce a boost, which will take this observer and move him to the center and move this observer off to the side. So they're absolutely equivalent. This surface is completely homogeneous and isotropic. So far, so good. Now,
and you can be incredibly strong.
Yes.
Yeah, it boosts it surely. When you make boost, it boosts like
perfectly. That's what I'm saying. So as long as I have a single bubble, things are perfectly homogeneous. So that's the picture. So I should say. So although it's true on this metaphysical scale, things are very inhomogeneous. You say I don't worry because inside the bubble things look perfectly homogeneous, and that's where I live. Yeah. So far, so good. But now we have to worry a bit.
I prefer to move myself close to the wall.
Don't move yourself close to the wall. but do worry that you have another effect to consider, which is the effect of bubble collisions. Okay? So it's not true that my bubble just goes out on its own. I have to worry about the fact that there are bubble collisions. In fact, over time, okay, with eventually the entire surface of my bubble, except for an exponentially rare fraction of it, will have collisions on one side of the other side of bubbles. So now let's think about what the effect of these bubble collisions are. So now I've first begun with a case where I have two bubbles. Let's say I'm living in this bubble. Here's a bubble that collides with mine. I've chosen a special case where these two bubbles nucleate at the same time. We'll generalize in a minute. Okay, so these solid lines and dashed line, the solid line plus dashed line over here and solid line here represents where the bubble would have been if there were no collision, same for this one over here. Now I've turned them to dash where the two overlap. Because space-time that would have been there had there been no collision is kind of getting eaten out by the fact that there's a collision. When these two walls collide, there's some cataclysmic event. It's a highly relativistic collision. These bubble walls move out at the speed of light. There's some cataclysmic collision. It produces lots of matter and radiation, and also produces lots of curvature, as we'll see in a moment. What we're going to be interested in is focusing on this region over here, this overlap region over here, because regions out here, obviously, you didn't see the collision at all. In particular, I want to divide it up into two parts, so I don't end up double counting or miscounting. Part of what I'll call yellow, which is going to be the part that's going to be in my bubble, and the part which is gray-black. So the gray region is a region which, well, I can think of it in two ways. The gray region is a region which would have been there had it not had a collision, but that piece of space-time is eaten out.
What does eaten out mean?
It no longer exists. So in particular, if you think about these hyperboloids, they normally would have gone off to infinity, and that would, in fact, be an infinite volume out there at the edge of those hyperboloids. The collision of the other bubble cuts it off and leaves you, they've overlapped. Essentially, that space-time no longer exists because they've collided. Instead, you get this bubble cut off here and this bubble cut off here, and a volume that wouldn't have been there isn't there because the other bubble isn't there in its place. On this side, in other words, the volume continues. If I pick one of these surfaces and I integrate the volume over per unit radius from the center, it diverges as I go out to here. Here, it begins to diverge, but then it gets cut off. Then over on this side, I'm supposed to use a different vector surface. It also gets cut off. And then you go one more step further. Well, so over here, it gets cut off. Over here, it gets cut off. So a hyperbole that would have been there isn't getting there. It's segmented to the other bubble. So what I want to do is talk about observers, let's say, in our bubble, and an equivalent description would exist for observers in this bubble. I just don't want to double count and count volume that doesn't really exist once I include the bubble.
So this emits a light ray from the brown region, and it's oriented, so it might ordinarily reach us in the center of your initial region. Would it be there, you're saying?
It would.
So then that space time, that region of space doesn't exist. You can see someone from the
side. Yeah. The gray represents two things at once. The gray represents two things at once. Unfortunately, it exists in the same place on my figure. I can't describe it. It represents one, a piece that's cut out that would have existed in our bubble but doesn't. And in this picture, it's also observers which now exist in the other bubble but couldn't communicate with ours and need to communicate with theirs. The next picture will make it clear.
Can I say what I get from this and see it on whale face?
Yeah.
If I count if those two things were far apart and I counted the number, a certain number of cubic meters, I'd get a number.
Yes.
And when I put them there, there's half as many cubic meters in that thing. So one is, well, for every, is one cubic meter.
Except it's worse than that. It's infinite to now find.
Yeah, no. That's right.
Right. Any, not worse than that, but different than that.
Every spot, that red spot.
Right.
Represents
that's right. So the vine that would have been occupied by observers in this bubble now have crossed over to the other side.
That red spot's only one cubic meter, not two. Mm-hmm. So there's one cubic meter missing.
This point will not be so important for our discussion. So, and if it is, we'll go
back. I suspect I want to understand it from any other reason.
So what I want to focus on is observers on our side, and then make the same analysis that applies to this side, particular observers in this red region. Now, these observers, before they get here, notice that they probably began from somewhere back here. They've done some normal evolution. They've seen inflation. They've seen the homogeneous and isotropic universe. And then they enter here. And when they enter here, what they see is something quite different on the left or on the right. Okay, on the left, they see, of course, the usual inflation and Big Bang story. On the right, they see some scar left over from this collision. In particular, not only is there the matter of radiation or domain wall, whatever there is that's left over from this collision, but notice that I have to somehow connect this uniform curvature hypersurface for this uniform curvature hypersurface. You know, and I have to do that on both sides. There's going to be some sort of curvature change there. It's clearly different on this side and this side. How different will be very important. It's not, you know, exactly how different this will be and how different this will be is an important issue here. But at least naively, it seems to be very different, okay? Because here you see normal inflation, here you see, in fact, something cut off.
I mean, if the...
So essentially, the yellow observers, in other words, my point is, see an anisotropic universe. Yes.
If the bubble nucleation rate is small enough, then we can make a universe inside the bubble big enough for ourselves. So
good point, Martin. Excellent point, Martin, and we'll get back to it. No, we're working our way towards that. Yeah.
If you assume the initial surface is highly homogeneous, and if you have lots of bundles, it seems highly improbable that you end up homogeneous as a
problem. Yes. Yeah. This is profoundly disturbing because it already began with the most beneficial conditions. Now let me point out something that's more even more disturbing about it, which is this observer can tell where he is with respect to the center of the bubble. Because you can tell that he's closer to this side than to this side. Truly bizarre, since I began with what appeared to be perfectly de Sitter invariant initial conditions, and I chose a perfectly homogeneous surface. How did I manage to break that symmetry? Well, the answer to Riga, Goose, and Blank can point out is, the moment that I chose this initial value surface, I broke the symmetry. That there's one observer in this bubble who's at rest, imagine putting dust along here. There's one observer who's at rest with respect to that. All other observers along this hypersurface are boosted with respect to that. That distinguishes the center, so-called center observer, from all the other observers. Okay, and the memory of who's the center, who's not the center, persists whether the inflation is this much or this much, or arbitrarily finite amount. So any notion that you are inoculated from the initial conditions over time is incorrect. That's a profound difference in our view of inflation, not a small change. Whether it's certainly a philosophical change, whether it's a practical difference, will come to.
I don't quite, I mean, first of all, that the time, the directions of the observers in the bubble should be drawn so that they
just on time, but I'm having you look back and I'm having you look out along light. I'm saying if you see the light from those. Talking about these lines?
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that doesn't mean looking back in time and seeing what he sees on both sides.
But I'm trying to, does the observer in the left bubble really see a center, or is there sort of the distance from the collision?
He can tell with respect to the center because once he enters the zone where he's seeing bubble collisions, he can tell if there's more bubble collisions on one side than on the other side. That tells him where he is with respect to the center.
point
to where the center is, of the universe is.
Yeah. One side and
yeah, where density of bubble collisions, the distribution of bubbles will be different on one side than the other that we see. It takes them a much longer, there'll be bubble collisions on this side, but of course
there will be a few very big bubbles that collide soon, and then very light.
Hold on. I got to work my way towards that. So here you've just done the two-level gauge. Now, to represent what's going on, if you want to kind of follow what's going on in one of the surfaces, we'll take one of these hypersurfaces, hyperbolic hypersurfaces, and map it into the Poincaré circle, essentially mapping the hyperboloid into a circle. So here's hyperbolic coordinate going to infinity over here, and then here's the center of the bubble. And the case we've just worked is the case where, so if there were no collision, we have an entire circle of white in this picture. When there is a collision, essentially the space time that would have existed here has been cut out, the space time that would have existed here has been cut out, and they join along these, the two bubbles are joining along these two interfaces. I hope that makes a little bit clearer what I was trying to say. So gray represents, gray really represents, I probably should use a different color for the one. What I'm really going to use is to represent the part that's cut out that doesn't exist. Now, this is, of course, the case of the two bubbles we nucleate at the same time. We want to consider all possible bubble nucleations, ones in which one occurred before the other and vice versa. And the way to do that, simply enough, is to boost frames. The boost are equal collision frames, and boost the picture. So what happens is that this picture gets boosted to this one. So this is a case where our bubble was formed first, and this bubble was formed much later. And what you see is then a small little bite is taken out of ours, in this case, and a huge bite is taken out of a little bubble. And so that's the effect of one bubble collision. But of course, you don't just have one bubble collision. You're going to have bubble collisions that occur all along the space-time until you actually fill the entire ring, or nearly fill the entire ring, up to an exponentially small error. So what you get is a whole bunch of bites taken out of the thing in the end. So we would live, so the interior of the bubble, the only real space-time, is the white part here, not the black part. Yes?
Can one suppress the formation of these bubbles by having a very large barrier initially, or?
Yes.
You can have bubbles that are incredibly small and you still form them no matter how.
Hold on a bit. And if you're asking all the right questions, but I can't answer, I will answer your question, but it will make a difference with the bubble nucleation where it is. Now, around every one of these bites,
of course, is a yellow region. Okay, which is observers who actually can, who have, depending on the slice I chose, are far enough, you know, are close enough away to a bite that they can actually see this anisotropy here. So what we're interested in is the ratio of the yellow regions to the white regions here. Okay, so.
Hypothesis, right?
That's right.
So, for example, if you observe up in the center or somewhere, I guess you're assuming that we are right in the center. Otherwise,
I'm not assuming. No, I don't want to.
Well, as you said, you can just do the boost and then it should completely change it, right? So,
what I actually want to know is how likely we are to be in a white region which has not yet seen such a collision versus a yellow region which does see such a collision. Because yellow observers will see an anisotropic universe, and white observers will still see what looks like an isotropic universe.
This yellow region is where this light cone hits.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, so I'm inside the light cone of the collision event, so I can actually see back to the collision event. But I'm not getting quite far away from that.
How do you define the proper, time slice to measure properly?
No, you can look over time.
This
is another confusing point. So you're talking about some classical intervention or some quantum state? If you're given the Schuster space, perfect Schuster space, Schuster space, I suppose, has the very high invariance, like Poincaré.
That's right. So, but it's very important that inflationary theory is not the pure Schuster space. And the moment you have, because if it were, you never end up ending inflation. And the moment you have a mechanism that can end the De Sitter phase, like a bubble nucleation.
Yeah, well, that breaks the thing you're going to say.
Exactly. Okay. So the point is, now we're studying how the effect of the deviation from De Sitter invariance makes its way inside the bubble. So we already talked about the macroscopic scale, where it makes its way by producing patches. Okay. But now we're talking about how the information makes its way inside the bubble. The answer is through bubble collisions, or at least one way through bubble collisions. It may also be initial conditions. But so, at the moment, we've chosen a specific initial condition, which was the most favorable, and we're going from there.
So just to clarify, that's a mapping of a space-like surface onto the Poincaré disk at a particular instant.
Exactly.
And so that yellow region and white region will change over time.
Exactly.
So you're deciding at some time.
This is just a cartoon.
What you want to figure out as a function of time, what the probability is you're in the yellow versus the white.
Exactly.
So related to that question, so eventually you will be in the yellow region.
Eventually everyone's going to be in the yellow region.
Okay.
Yeah, but well, it's just a matter of time.
Okay.
So by the way, let me emphasize that in this, I mean, talk about histology, when you do this mapping to the Poincaré disk, your most of the volume lies on the outside. Okay, so this is Escher's famous print of angels and devils, in which the angels and devils are spaced uniformly on the hyperbolic surface, and then he maps it to the Poincaré circle, and so you can see a lot more angels and devils out here than in here. So most observers are near the edge. Okay, so you can see actually that most of the volume, all but a set of measures zero, the volume of the bubble actually ends up getting eaten away. Okay, so but what we're interested in is not that. We're interested in is what the relative measures of these two things are. Yeah.
So in a dark, in a lambda universe, you don't, you know, your past light cone doesn't keep getting wider and wider.
So yes. So in a peculiar way, dark energy protects you ultimately from, if you haven't seen anything up to this point, protects you from seeing it in the future. So it's a bizarre relationship between dark energy and inflation, because without it, eventually the universe becomes, will be anisotropic everywhere. So that's another interesting phenomenon. Okay. Now, let me finally get to it. So here, I'm going to show you here's some simulations of this effect, and I should emphasize that these are done with Alex Salen, speaking of Princeton, and I should emphasize that these are preliminary results. So I wish this was a week from now, I'd be a lot more confident in them, but at the moment I should say these are preliminary results, not just to pique your interest. But essentially what we've done is actually do this simulation over time. So first of all, I'll show you a series of simulations where we're watching the bubbles just eating out of these regions from the bubble collisions. And as you would expect, and this is a time sequence, and as you'd expect, you eat out more and more with time, although you don't necessarily, although at least this eating out process, well, for example, in the case we have two equal-sized bubbles, those, you don't eat out. The bite that you take out never reaches the center.
So the fact that these are kind of look like they're almost stopped after a certain point is sort of typical of what you get in these kinds of simulations. And now I'll superimpose on that the yellow regions, the set of observers, for example, there. You can see the set of observers who are able to see back to that anisotropy. And so here's how the sequence goes. Going, gone. So eventually, as was suggested in the back, eventually, if you wait long enough, every observer is going to see, is going to be in this yellow, in this potentially dangerous yellow zone. Now, where we are, so as a philosophical issue, this really emphasizes my point, that ultimately, inflation is a disordering influence, even inside the bubbles, not an ordering influence. Now, that's a philosophical point. Now, as a practical point, you want to know is, how relevant is this for us, actually? You know, how practical is it? Have we lived long enough that we should be in this yellow zone or in this white zone? What should we expect? And what our preliminary results suggest is this depends upon two factors. The bubble, that's already been anticipated, the bubble nucleation rate, which I've called gamma, and the age of the universe, or how much time has transpired since the end of inflation. Now, in the toy model that was considered, and in many of the discussions of this that have happened since, people have, there's the freedom to choose the barrier to adjust the nucleation rate. And you can make the nucleation rate very, very small to an arbitrary degree, so that when you take the product of the age ratio and gamma, you get a number which is very, very small. And what that turns out to mean in terms of this sequence is that where we are in this sequence is somewhere up in that upper left-hand corner, where you're more likely to be white than you are to be yellow. Yeah. Which, to be in that corner, you think? Oh, well, these are both, this number we know. We know it's within, we know it's of order 10 to the 50th or something. It's a ratio of inflation. Yeah, so as we know, this to be of order something like 10 to the 50th. This number is an adjustable parameter, which can easily be 10 to the minus 100, 10 to the minus 1,000, et cetera. So we can definitely adjust this, if this were the only course we had to worry about, to be arbitrarily small. So we can save ourselves if this is the only source of problem. I wouldn't say it's a particularly tuned parameter. Okay, but what you have less flexibility with is another effect of internal inflation, which we were casting out before, but now I wanted to raise again, which is the fact that even when we were on the plateau in general, or you're on a phi-squared inflation or phi-fourth inflation, there's another internal inflation effect due just to the fact that you have quantum fluctuations kicking you back and forth on the potential. So, for example, in this flat potential, there's some regime where if I'm far enough on it, in fact, this quantum activation is more important than the classical effect. And so the field remains up here, and we end up going internal inflation. Every now and then, some region diffuses down to here, rolls downhill, and we produce something which is very much like a bubble, that is to say a patch, which is ended inflation, while most of the universe is ending up there still in that quantum diffusion regime. And the thing about this effect is you don't have a control parameter, like a barrier, to control what the rate is. This is calculable in most models. So for example, for phi squared, phi fourth, or slow roller inflation, this time it takes to go downhill is small. The effective nucleation rate is small, but not terribly small. Something like 10 to the minus 20 or 10 to the minus 10, which we're then going to multiply by the age ratio, which is 10 to the 50th. So if this idea is right, it seems like we're in a regime where instead of this product being small, for these kinds of cases, for this kind of eternal inflation effect, the product is large. And that ends up putting us in... So in almost all inflation models, you would get this eternal inflation. You can rig models so that they have steep... You can construct models. People have constructed very artificial models where you put something right at the front end, which is steep enough to the plateau that you will, you know, that you'll keep bumping up against it due to the quantum diffusion. You won't get much of this eternal inflation effect. And so it may be in those cases one can save the day. But it's adding something very artificial to the model that you never thought you needed before. It eliminates almost, you know, most models that people have been thinking about. If this ends up being a problem, it would eliminate most models that people have thought about and only leads you to another kind of artificial addition to it. Yeah, that, and this, yeah, I could have done, I happened to, I
choose this model, I could have, the same thing would apply for phi squared, phi fourth, you know, same thing would occur for chaotic inflation models.
So in this...
Even when the density, the density begins with Planck density, you ask how long on average it takes to get to the bottom.
But here we're supposed to assume eternal inflation occurs on the flat part, and then there's
kinds of models, eternal inflation occurs somewhere. The potential you can hardly see this getting flatter and flatter and flatter. If it gets flatter enough, eventually you'll have eternal inflation at a plateau, just as the same way. These are just different. It's all the same effect. So in this case, when the product is large, instead of ending up in the other pinch point, you tend to end up somewhere actually in the middle, it turns out. But that's enough that typically it looks like, if these preliminary results are correct, that you're likely to end up someplace where it's most likely to be anisotropic rather than isotropic. And if this holds up, this is very bad news, because I don't know of any anthropic argument that would save the day. So as far as I can tell, there's something wrong with living in one of these anisotropic spaces. And that's the dominant volume, and you're more likely to live there to be, at least per bubble, you're more likely to live there than you are to live someplace else. So this is both interesting from a metaphysical point of view. It changed our view, helps emphasize the change in our view of inflation, but also perhaps from a practical point of view. So stay tuned. Yes?
So you've alluded to the collision of these two volumes as being a very violent event. Can you be more specific about what we would necessarily see if tomorrow
we had a huge anisotropy? So rate some packages completely unlike the rest of the Beavers.
Slava says it's the north-south asymmetry.
But huge north-south asymmetry. You're sitting over here saying this looks very different than this side.
It's an order unity change.
So, yeah, order unity change.
So, sorry, okay, we have to practice again.
Yes.
10 minutes.
Okay, good.
If you like, you listen to us at the discussion.
Absolutely. I realize these are fascinating issues, and it's hard to explain them all in one blast, so I've been doing my best. Okay, so one other problem which I wanted to mention before we went out talking about problems is a problem which, well, it's long ago been raised by Roger Penrose, and which people have different attitudes about, but let me present it anyway to add it to the list. And this is the entropy problem. I mentioned before that Booth viewed inflation as a solution to the entropy problem. By a solution, I meant an explanation of why the entropy is so large, 10 to the 90th, rather than of order unity. But Penrose's attitude is that actually the entropy of the universe is anomalously low. We know that the maximal entropy of the universe, well, we have a lower bound than the maximal entropy of the universe today. It's 10 to the 120th. And for some reason, our universe only has an entropy of 10 to the 90th. And remember, this is a log of the number of degrees of freedom. An entropy is a log of the number of degrees of freedom. So in terms of phase space, we're comparing E to the 10 to the 120. We're compared to E to the 10 to the 90. Another way of saying it is that here's the full phase space that would be available to the universe. And where we find ourselves today is not where most of phase space is, but in some special place with an anomalously low entropy. And then we're led to the challenge we have in cosmology is to explain how we ended up here rather than in some place typical. Now, given that we're here and that this space is so huge, you can see there's lots of paths that could get you to that point. However, what inflation does is not help the situation, but exacerbate it by producing lots of entropy. The only way that works is if you begin in a space with even less entropy. So you have to begin in an even smaller corner of phase space to start things going. So you have to begin in a very special place, then inflate, that's the inflationary path, as opposed to one of these many, many other paths of getting to. And so that's a version of the Penrose's puzzle. Now, some people, standard answer to this that I've heard, in fact, just recently, just this summer, from Andre Linde, is to say, okay, look, when the universe begins, it's natural to suppose that the only important dimensional scale in the universe is the Planck scale. That sets the horizon scale. That sets the energy density. And that produces the initial conditions sufficient to put you in that corner. How far do we find that explanation is a matter of taste? I personally find it just a redefinition of the problem. It begins, first of all, the notion that the universe begins, which already assumes an arrow of time, which already assumes that you're somehow at low entropy moving to high entropy. Okay, and in particular, when you use a dimensional argument, the dimensional argument simply translates directly into the statement that the entropy within the horizon is of order 1, rather than what a typical value is available to you. So it's just, you know, it's an argument which I think in my view, restates the problem, doesn't explain why you began. Doesn't explain why you began, and not particularly at that point at all, why there was a beginning at all, but set the time, and doesn't explain why you began with the only dimensional scale being the Planck scale, when an entropy argument would suggest you should have gotten something exponentially bigger. Now, there have been various attempts to explain this entropy problem, and I won't go to each one of these, except I just point out that it turns out that all these various attempts so far don't tend to lead to inflation. In particular, the tunneling from nothing idea, the no-boundary proposal I mentioned, that tends to lead you to is a universe with a very small energy density, small vacuum energy density, which is nearly empty, or a small Hubble constant, rather than something which has a large Hubble constant, which is inflated. And there are similar issues with these others. So we don't have a solution. So if you talk about inflation now, although our classical view of inflation is one which has been marvelously supported by the data, in the meantime, I would say that our theoretical view of inflation has been undergoing a profound and subtle change. And it's led to a series of interesting problems. People will have different viewpoints as to which problems they consider to be more serious than the others, but I think they're all problems that one ought to consider. In particular, the singularity problem means that in a very fundamental way, the inflationary theory is incomplete until you have a theory of a singularity. the predictability problem, at least for my taste, takes away the most important aspects of inflation, which is this powerful predictive power. I, for one, would not want to be dragged into a court of law for the standard statement that WMAP has proven the inflationary prediction that the universe is flat. Because I know a prosecutor would draw up a paper on internal inflation and say, but hold it, you could, what if they've seen the result of it? It could just as well have been lived in a different open pocket universe. So I think it really does take away at the moment our current understanding the powerfully predictive character to it. Persistence of memory problems is a very interesting effect. We have just begun to explore it. We don't know, haven't even thought about inhomogeneous initial conditions yet. We've thought about even just these ideal cases, but you can see why it's important. It threatens the prediction of isotropy. And the entropy problem essentially turns what was supposed to be an advantage into a problem. And the other problems which I haven't mentioned, they force enough. Now, since it's a conference on the frontiers of modern cosmology, this means there's work to be done. For theorists, we have basically two choices. We have to find ways to solve these problems within the context of inflation, or we have to begin to seek alternative models that avoid these problems. And of course, if you're an observer, you can help us a lot by conducting tests that will enable us to distinguish between inflation and its alternatives. But let me point out why I'm a little pessimistic about inflation, solving these problems with it in the context of inflation. So if I ask myself what has been causing all the problems I discussed, there are two common elements, two features which are important, two inescapable features of inflation. One is that inflation, the smoothing occurs in a very fast way. When the universe is expanding very fast. And the Hubble constant in the smoothing phase, the inflationary phase, is bigger than it is in the normal matter radiation dominated phase, and certainly much bigger than it is today.
And secondly, the fact that quantum physics is inherently random. These two combine to cause all the problems. They lead to the fact that because the Hubble constant is big in the smoothing phase, it's the smoothing phase that dominates most of the space-time volume, and only occasional pockets of normal volume are produced. And those normal volumes are subject to quantum randomness, and so you will get an infinite number of each variety. It's also this same combination that leads to the possibility of them colliding and the persistence of memory effect. It's also true that if you begin with the universe with H big, and it only gets bigger going backwards in time, you are assuming that the entropy of the universe is initially small. So you're just assuming the entropy solution rather than explaining it. And it's the fact that H is positive, and that is used in the singularity theorems to prove, or ever positive, to prove that you run into this cosmic singularity. That leads to the singularity problem. So if we're going to get around these problems, it seems to me that one has to change one or the others of these. I don't intend to change this one. So I would suggest that maybe we ought to think about changing the other one. So let's imagine somehow we managed to begin with a smoothing phase in which H is smaller than it is in the normal phase, rather than bigger. Let's just imagine it for a moment. Let's not worry about how we managed to do it, but let's just imagine that we did it. So that means you have a smoothing phase in which the expansion is slow, and then when you finally produce the pocket of normal phase, it would expand much more rapidly. So it would become the dominant volume. Normal universe would become the dominant volume rather than the smoothing volume. So you wouldn't end up so, and in fact, the system would percolate, if you imagine it being some kind of bubble process, it would percolate almost instantaneously, so you don't get the large inhomogeneities, you don't get the unpredictability problem, the persistence of memory. But
we have to, imagine I solve a smoothing process which smooths the universe out, solves the horizon problem, solves the flatness problem, and then H becomes big afterwards when you get the normal phase. That's what I'm imagining for the moment. Imagine I could do that. Okay.
Okay.
Well, that's my job. singularity problem. The entropy problem. Remember, I said the no boundary proposal. The natural place to end up is a space which is nearly empty with a small Hubble constant. So actually, coming from nothing to a smoothing phase. Actually does fit together, at least with that particular proposal. So the potential solution, potential avenue for solving the entropy problem, As to the singularity problem, well, let's, before we ask that question about the singularity problem, ask how are we ever going to get from a small Hubble constant to a large Hubble constant? But in the context of general relativity, we know that h dot is negative so long as rho should energy density plus p is positive. Okay, I'll try to finish up quickly. We know h dot is negative so long as the combination of rho plus p is positive, which is to say that if you begin with, if you assume the universe has always been expanding, h strictly decreases with time. Therefore, the only way you're going to go from a small h to a large h is if you have some kind of balance. So what I'm arguing is that if these problems for inflationary survive, inflation survive, they begin to become serious, they maintain themselves as serious problems, then what that's basically telling us is the avenue of attack in which we assume that the universe began, let's say, in a big bang and has been expanding all along, doesn't work. You have to turn instead to a model which has some kind of balance. In fact, all the solutions that I know to these problems involve some kind of balance. So it must have a balance, which means these approaches must confront the singularity. They can't avoid it. Okay, so either way, whether inflation or in these alternatives, we have to know what happens with the balance, whether that is the beginning and all memory is lost of what happened before, or something can be transmitted from before to after. Now, we do know there are smoothing mechanisms that exist with small h. For example, in Penrose's conformal cyclic cosmology, he actually uses dark energy. The phase is w equals minus 1, a kind of low-scale inflation. Doesn't really explain how you get density fluctuations, but he's using this as the smoothing process. And we know now in the because we know that over time, this component in the expanding universe of w equals minus 1 dominates the space-time. In the ekpyrotic cyclic models, there's a different technique that we use. Dark energy does help smooth the universe out, but the real smoothing occurs during the contraction phase, a contraction phase in which you have an energy component with w much bigger than 1. An energy component with w much bigger than 1, as the scale factor shrinks, dominates all over all these other contributions and essentially eliminates any flatness or anisotropy that existed beforehand. So in short, we know there are smoothing mechanisms that are available, at least two examples of smoothing mechanisms that are available, either in an expanding phase or in a contracting phase. The second one is particularly interesting because it does produce a scale invariant spectrum of fluctuations. What I try to provide is a perspective on inflation which explains, A, why it's important that we address some of these fundamental problems that underlie it, and B, suggests a reason why we should be looking at alternatives. Thank you.
Basically, you already stripped my three questions because it's so exciting metaphysical stuff. I do not want to.
I probably missed it. All right. What's the experimental thing?
Well, you missed a bunch of things. Okay, the most key tasks to perform for us is to look into the gravitational waves. Because what the gravitational waves are telling us in a very general sense is what the value of H was during the smoothing phase. So it's the most direct, and their amplitude is proportional to that. And the spectrum also depends on H changing with time. So that's clearly the most important thing to measure.
But, Paul, you put in principle that any gravitational waves and then, you know, the Oceanic is in so-called non-trivial inflationary scenarios.
So I think
there is no difference.
I think I followed enough to know that your idea would survive a non-detection of gravitational waves.
They acquire. If you see them, then this whole then we know, and that helps us. That's essentially what should help sort out the possibility. We have these problems, and one avenue of attack, the second avenue of attack, one avenue is inflation, the other avenue is to have some kind of bounce. And I believe that all the bouncing ones, because inherently all the effects occurring at small h, will give you undetectable gravitational waves. So yes,
you can get also undetectable gravitational waves at higher inflation. And in this sense, actually, this bounce is
I don't want to get into that. Yeah. Let me mention that the other thing is
two
galaxy fluctuation. Yeah. Which can also provide.
Right. So we will take two more questions, and then we will go. Okay. You should, then you answer. Okay.
So Paul. So are you suggesting that there are some contributive effects that can change the predictions of calculating inflation, like phi square and phi four effects? So So the models that Larman and collaborators used to feed the WMAP data are incorrect because they didn't include those non-perturbative effects?
The bubble collision effects, you mean?
Yeah.
If I told you my results are preliminary, but that is what the conclusion you have to reach. If those, that almost all models that, certainly models of that type, would violate the
Have you actually done any calculation for phi 4 and phi squared, or just for this?
Yes.
Okay, you have
them. Yeah. So as long as you don't have a barrier separating the two, as long as it's some sort of smooth rolling, essentially most of your time is spent diffusing out of this quantum phase. So basically from the Planck density down to some density where classical effects will dominate. And you can calculate pretty quickly, back of an envelope, how long that takes, okay, and how many Hubble times that takes. So given a patch which is initially completely up there, guess how long will it take before some patch reaches the bottom? Okay. And it takes a certain amount of time, but not an enormous amount of time.
But Paul, you realize that the system fusion strongly depends on the choice of measure. Indeed, you find you the measure, okay, which will tell you that you are living in the center of the universe. They basically propose this thing. Because when you deal with the heat, it works already for 10 years. Yeah, and the measure which gives you that you are living close to the bubble walls, of course, there exists this measure, but there exists the other measure which would take you away from the bubble walls.
I don't, if the calculation I showed you is right,
choice of measure is a different thing, because you know that there is actually right now fighting. Okay, for 10 years, which is going on.
I think the measure you're talking about is a different measure. Yeah. You're talking about the measure of bubble to bubble. Okay, you're asking, given that there are many different types of bubbles, what kind of bubble and where am I most likely to live?
No, I am talking about decision for deciding the heater surface of constant time. Okay, where you are comparing different probabilities.
Different bubbles, though.
Yeah,
but we're talking about within any given bubble.
Yeah.
What's the ratio of
I don't think within a bubble. Okay.
I would say that the only examples I know, well, other people obviously speak that issue, people have become a more prime issue. I would say that almost all the examples I know give you a term of inflation in one form or another, unless you're using very special to predict the potential. So that when you fluctuate uphill, you need to kick downhill or something like that. They're very, I mean, it's not the kind of models that people are designing for the most part. There's some rare examples known, but they're very artificial compared to what most people say. But there is a loophole. They said it was impossible, but I said at this point it's been very rare. But it used to be rare for people to make models with small amplitude gravitational waves, and that seems to be not more popular lately. So we'll have to see how popular, that's a population, popularization issue more than a fact issue.
Okay, so I think you have to press it. Thanks for this one.